From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Multimillionaire Jeffrey Epstein is charged with sex trafficking underage girls. The charges come more than a decade after receiving a sweetheart plea deal for similar crimes. U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Jeffrey Berman, announced the charges.
The victims, all underage girls at the time of the alleged conduct, were given hundreds of dollars in cash after each encounter, either by Epstein or by one of Epstein's employees.
And it's not just Epstein under fire. Labor Secretary Alex Acosta is under the microscope for his role in sealing that original deal when he was U.S. attorney in Florida. This hour on Point, the investigative reporter who broke the story and gave Epstein's victims a voice. Join us. Is this case Exhibit A of how money can buy you leniency? What's your question for our investigative reporter? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Joining me from New York is Julie Brown. She's the Miami Herald investigative reporter behind the paper's groundbreaking series, Perversion of Justice. When U.S. Attorney Jeffrey Berman announced the charges against Epstein on Monday, he said prosecutors were, quote, assisted by some excellent investigative journalism, referring to Brown's reporting. Julie Brown, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
What extraordinary work you have done here. First, tell us, who is Jeffrey Epstein?
Jeffrey Epstein was born in New York, raised in Brooklyn, went to college briefly, never received a degree, ended up getting hired as a teacher, and eventually made some connections in Wall Street and worked for Bear Stearns, and then went out on his own and started representing very wealthy people across the world and made a lot of money in investing all these clients' millions of dollars and helping them evade paying taxes, essentially.
The U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York said that the charges against Jeffrey Epstein shock the conscience. What are the charges?
There are one count of sex trafficking, one count of conspiracy to commit sex trafficking. These charges relate to apparently some new evidence that they received here in New York that he was doing this in his new Manhattan mansion, the same kind of operation that he was running out of Palm Beach, Florida, in which he had girls coming to his home, you know, 2, 3, 4 times a day. Essentially, he hired them to perform massages, but in reality, what he was doing was molesting them.
You did some incredible work to get these victims to open up. You identified at least 80 victims, most of them between the ages of 13 and 16. Here is one victim, Virginia Roberts, speaking to the Miami Herald about an alleged encounter with Jeffrey Epstein when she was just 16 years old.
It ended with sexual abuse and intercourse, and then a pat on the back. You've done a really good job. Like, you know, thank you very much, and here's $200. You know, before you know it, I'm being lent out to politicians and to academics and to people that you, royalty, and people that you just, you would never think, like, how did you get into that position of power in the first place?
Roberts continues by saying she hopes to see the government take action against Epstein.
I think it's something that the government just can't ignore anymore. There's so many of us that they just can't forget about it. It's not something that's going to be yesterday's news.
Was it difficult to find these victims, Julie Brown?
Yeah, that was a very time-consuming process because, remember, they were all minors when this happened, so none of their names were public. The police reports, all the documents, the court documents and everything referred to these victims as Jane Doe number 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to 124. I mean, it was a lot of painstaking searching through redacted records, hoping to find little details to figure out who they were. And ironically, after I spent months doing that, you know, well into the project, I had fortunately got some sources that understood what I was doing, willing to help me. me. I got an unredacted copy of the police report leaked to me, which contained all the names of all the girls that I had already tracked. That, and in fact, there were a couple of new ones on there. So it was kind of funny how that happened, that I did all that work.
This is very much a chance for these victims to see justice, because many of them feel very much overlooked after the first time that Epstein was charged. Tell us about that.
Well, it really wasn't just that they were overlooked. They were they felt that they were betrayed by first they suffered the trauma that they went through with Epstein. Then, of course, you know, these were young girls and they had to go through the whole experience with their parents and dealing with making them recognize what was going on, which is traumatizing, and their families. And then they had to deal with state prosecutors who didn't take them very seriously, didn't handle them very well. And then after that, they had Epstein's lawyers grilling them. And, you know, lawyer Alan Dershowitz would come into the state prosecutor's office and basically say, these are all prostitutes. They did it willingly. And here's a dossier on this one girl. And by the way, here she is on MySpace and she's drinking a beer. And then they went after the police that were investigating. And then they had lawyers grilling them and private investigators following them. And so this was years of betrayal and treating these girls like they were basically child prostitutes, which we all know there is really no such thing as a child prostitute.
Well, Jeffrey Epstein was very much enabled. I mean, it appears from your reporting that many people knew what was going on here.
Yes, and that's almost developing into a bigger story here, because let's think about this. These were prosecutors that were, you know, that were supposed to protect these girls and advocate for these girls. And instead, the records show that they were working and meeting secretly with Epstein's lawyers. And these emails that went back and forth that we discovered in the court files that were so chummy between these prosecutors and Epstein's lawyers, it was disturbing to me to think that they would speak to each other in such collegial terms, considering the seriousness of the charges that we were talking about here.
So now Labor Secretary Alex Acosta was the federal prosecutor in South Florida at the time. There's a human side to this story, which you've been so beautifully describing the horrific nature of, and the political side of this. What is Alex Acosta's role? What was it then? What is it now?
Well, Alex Acosta was and to some degree really still is a well-regarded U.S. attorney out of Miami. He prosecuted some very important drug trafficking cases in Florida, cartel cases, and, you know, that resulted in some big time kingpins going to prison forever. But in this, it's really been a mystery in this case why he seemed to back down, because initially it appeared that he did want to federally prosecute Epstein. In fact, what happened was Epstein's lawyers were putting together these long legal briefs saying that there is no federal jurisdiction in this case. Normally, the federal government does not take up sex abuse cases, but in this particular case, they were trying to make a sex trafficking case, which is certainly a federal jurisdiction. But in order to do that, they had to have certain mechanisms in place. For example, that the fact that Epstein was using the telephone to make these appointments, that was, you know, that's telecommunications kind of thing. That was a mechanism that they were trying to make. In any event, initially Acosta, judging from the documents that I reviewed, he was plowing forward with trying to make that case. And then somewhere along the line, something just kind of suddenly changed. And all of a sudden, he just decided, no, we'll make this plea deal. It's sort of it seemed like a change at a point when he met privately with one of Epstein's attorneys, Jay Lefkowitz, in a sort of this Marriott well away from Miami. It was this kind of unusual meeting between these two lawyers who had roots in the same law firm of Kirkland & Ellis.
And And Epstein was given after that a remarkably light prison sentence, right? 13 months in the county jail in a private wing of the jail, and really not even there much. 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. He was out of jail on work release in his office and came, I guess, back to the jail to sleep.
Yeah, and he had his own private detail at the jail. He had his own valet picking him up every day, taking him to his office. He had visitors in his office. We can't even find out who those visitors were because the Palm Beach Sheriff's Office claims, anyway, that they no longer have the logbooks. So we don't even know if he had women. For all we know, he had women back there, and he was One of the deputies that did that detail, you know, he had deputies outside, standing outside his office, said it wasn't his job to go in and make sure he was behaving himself, so to speak. So we really don't even know what he was doing during those hours.
Here's another interview with one of Epstein's alleged victims. In an interview with Savannah Guthrie on the Today Show this morning, Jennifer Arose alleged that Epstein assaulted and raped her when she was 15 years old. She said she was recruited outside her New York City high school to provide sexual massages for the financier.
Did Jeffrey Epstein rape you?
Yeah, no, he raped me. Forcefully raped me, but knew exactly what he was doing. And I don't think cared. What hurts even more so is that if I wasn't afraid to come forward sooner, then maybe he wouldn't have done it to other girls. I feel really guilty. To this day, I feel really guilty.
Julie Brown, where is Jeffrey Epstein right now?
That was really hard for me to hear. I mean, I'm sorry, but I interviewed a lot of those women, and I feel that they feel so bad about themselves, and that was the hardest part of this story.
We'll talk more with you after the break. Julie, stick with us. The Miami Herald investigative reporter who broke this story about Jeffrey Epstein. We're discussing money, power, and justice in the wake of the second round of charges against this wealthy financier. You can join us, listeners. Have you been following the case? What are you hearing in Julie Brown's horrifying account of what happened to these young girls? I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about the horrifying allegations of sexual abuse and sex trafficking of young girls by wealthy financier Jeffrey Epstein. You can join the conversation. What do you hear in the stories of Epstein's victims? Should Labor Secretary Alex Acosta resign? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Many of Jeffrey Epstein's alleged victims came from different and difficult backgrounds. Listen to Jenna Lisa Jones and Courtney Wild, who both said they were 14 when they were abused by Epstein in a video published by the Miami Herald.
The other girls that I personally know of that were coming from trailer parks, that were having gun shootings, drugs.
My mother was on drugs at the time, and she couldn't provide for me, and I was pretty much homeless.
I'm speaking this hour with Julie Brown, a Miami Herald investigative reporter who's behind the paper's groundbreaking series, Perversion of Justice. She broke all this. And joining me now from New York is Ellie Honig, former federal prosecutor for the Southern District of New York, as well as a CNN legal analyst. Ellie, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So as a former federal prosecutor, what are you hearing in this story, in this case?
Well, the thing that jumps out at me is just how much of an injustice this plea deal that the Southern District of Florida is that they reached with Jeffrey Epstein. This is, you can pick through three main things that jump out at me about this plea deal. First of all, the amount of time that he ended up serving 13 months in the conditions that you just discussed with Ms. Brown is an incredibly low amount of time for the, for offenses of this nature, for being involved in sex trafficking and human trafficking. 13 months is about the amount of time that people would receive for possessing a small amount, about 2 grams of crack cocaine. That's about half of a teaspoon. That's what 13 months means in the federal system. So that amount of time is inexplicable. But what takes this really from a bad deal to a suspicious deal is the way that now Secretary Acosta handled it when he was U.S. attorney. He did not notify the victims. You are required as a federal prosecutor to notify victims of a deal. And you learn that very early on in your time as a prosecutor. The fact that Acosta did not do that is inexplicable. Either he did it by accident, which means he was completely incompetent, or he did it on purpose, which means he wanted to keep this from coming out, and I suspect it's the latter, especially when you go to the third point, which is one of the features of this plea deal is that Acosta agreed to immunize Epstein's co-conspirators, meaning the people around Epstein. Now, that is something I've never done, never heard of, never discussed. It is completely unprecedented.
And what does that lead you to believe, Ellie? What does that say to you?
It says to me that that Acosta was in on the plan to keep this quiet.
And from your reporting, Julie Brown, were Epstein's lawyers, they were essentially negotiating. Is that the wrong word? They were negotiating with a criminal defendant.
Yeah, the judge, I don't even have to issue my opinion. The judge in this particular case recently ruled that not only did Acosta seal this and keep it from the victims, but they deliberately misled them into believing that they were still investigating it. And so what does that say? To me, it says it was a real concerted effort to cover up what happened, the scope of Epstein's crimes, and who else may have been involved.
And is it true, Julie Brown, that a federal judge later ruled that victims' rights were violated because they were not told about this deal?
Yes. The judge ruled that in February. And ironically, maddeningly, the Justice Department, this case now has been recused to the Northern District of Georgia. And the government is still now fighting those victims and saying that they are not going to do anything about what happened. They're not going to be able to remedy this or give them any kind of, hope that maybe there's a way to undo it, that there's no way to undo it. And by the way, they said, not only is there no way legally to do it, but we don't have to do this. It was almost a very cold response, like, we don't really think we did anything bad. So therefore, and the law doesn't, have any mechanism to repair this. So, see you later kind of thing, which is exactly how they treated these victims from the very beginning.
A lot of listener response to this story. Emily on Twitter says, thank you, Julie Brown, for your outstanding journalism. I have two middle school age daughters, and I'm disgusted at what happened. These women's voices are finally now being heard. Terry says, this is the most abhorrent scandal in recent memory. If we don't bring all these people to justice, including Acosta, our morals have collapsed. Here's Kathleen in Dayton, Ohio. Hi, Kathleen. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Julie. You, our show, have demonstrated so much empathy, compassion, and persistence. I mean, so many of us I know just completely celebrate your investigative reporting. I'm fascinated with the piece. I mean, first of all, it's just horrible to listen to these young, girls talk about how they feel guilty and, of course, incredibly used and abused. But the parallels between the Boston Globe's reporting on the Catholic Church are fascinating to me with this issue. It's like the disposable kids, disposable girls and boys. And so I want to talk about that structure that enables both those institutions, say the state of Florida justice situation and also the Catholic Church. Like, we are after the Ohio Attorney General to force the Catholic Church in Ohio to open up their books as the Attorney General forced Pennsylvania in Pennsylvania released. So could you draw any kind of parallels between those two disposable young people issues?
Yeah, got it. Kathleen, good question. Julie Brown?
Well, I did speak with a lawyer who handled or was a consultant in some of those Catholic Church cases. It was absolutely not lost on me that there were parallels with that. You're talking about a very powerful, church in one case and then our federal government in another case, and the way that they sort of ignored these cases. And it's similar in that they were poor boys, often in the Catholic Church scandal. That's the key. They prey on these kinds of people, prey on those that are most vulnerable for the specific reason that they know, they believe that law enforcement isn't going to believe them. And that's what happened in both of these cases, that the authorities didn't believe them. They were considered incredible. And what my story did, I interviewed experts, and what they pointed out is that law enforcement and prosecutors are woefully not trained well enough to understand very important elements of interviewing child abuse victims. One of the big elements is that they don't always remember. They're not reliable in every single memory because of the trauma. Your brain works differently when you're exposed to trauma. And so they look, because they gave one detail wrong or three details wrong, oh, that person's going to be a terrible witness, when in fact, it's the opposite. Because if you remember everything and you have this tried and true timeline, then you probably are lying, because that's not the way it works when you're abused. You don't remember details.
Kathleen, thanks so much for the call. Ellie Honig, I mean, the message this sends is sickening from a legal perspective, you know, that we've got two systems of justice in this country, one for the rich and one for the poor, that wealth insulates a serial sex abuser from consequence.
It really does, and it's a power imbalance. And I think what we're seeing in this case is one step towards progress there. When you have a group of wealthy, powerful, influential people arrayed on one side, as here, with a billionaire, Jeffrey Epstein, and his high-powered attorneys and all his connections on the one side, and then you have victims on the other. And as Julie just said, victims are often targeted and blamed. And it looks like that was the defense strategy that Jeffrey Epstein's legal team used to some avail, at least down in Florida. And I'm proud of my former office, Southern District of New York, for finally standing up for victims. And I've had experience doing cases based on victim testimony. And Julie's exactly right. Law enforcement needs to get better at learning how to deal with victims, how to gain their trust, and how to sort of empower them to make cases that need to be made.
I want to talk about the implications for Labor Secretary Acosta now. At his nomination hearing for Labor Secretary in 2017, Acosta was questioned by Democrat Senator from Virginia Tim Kaine about his decision to offer a plea deal to Epstein while serving as U.S. Attorney in Florida. Here's that.
There's an allegation that I just read that you did not pursue a federal indictment, even though your staff had advocated that you do so. Is that accurate?
The grand jury in Palm Beach County recommended a single count of solicitation not involving minors, I believe, and that would have resulted in zero jail time, zero registration as a sexual offender, and zero restitution for the victims in this case.
Is that true, Julie Brown?
No, he twisted that masterfully, because what Tim Kaine was asking him had nothing to do with the answer that he gave. Tim Kaine asked him about the federal prosecution. Why didn't you pursue the federal prosecution?
Right.
And he backpedaled to the state prosecution was a problem of itself, but that's not what Kaine asked him. And the reality is, it is true what Tim Kaine said. There were a couple of people in that office, I'm told one of the people, Marie Villafana, who was the lead prosecutor on that case, wanted to move forward to this. She's never told me that, but other people have told me that. But she was shot down. She was one of the few female prosecutors in that office. I think she tried to do the right thing, from what I understand, but she was shot down by all the other prosecutors surrounding her that felt that, oh, let's just make this go away.
I want to play this clip. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is one of several lawmakers pressuring Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta to step down, to leave his post because of his handling of the Epstein case.
I am calling on Secretary Acosta to resign. It is now impossible for anyone to have confidence in Secretary Acosta's ability to lead the Department of Labor.
Ellie Honig, Epstein will not get off so easy this time. What could be his sentence if convicted?
Well, he's looking at least a decade behind bars, I think, conservatively, if you sort of run through the federal sentencing calculation, which I won't do. But he's got an interesting decision to make, Epstein. He's really got three choices. One, he can go to trial, but the vast majority of federal defendants get convicted at trial. Looking at the indictment that came out, it looks to me like a fairly strong indictment. And if he goes to trial and gets convicted, he won't get out from jail probably in his remaining lifetime. Number two is he can try to plead guilty without cooperating. But if I'm back in my old seat in the Southern District, I'm not willing to give this guy any kind of break. I'm not even thinking about anything below the double digits, at least on a plea deal. And third, he can try to cooperate. Now, that's where things get interesting if he tries to cooperate, because if you cooperate as a federal defendant in the Southern District of New York, you have to give up everything you know about yourself and everybody else. Mm-hmm. Name names. Now, A, is he willing to do that? If he does, that's his best chance by far of getting a lower sentence. But B, is the Southern District interested in cooperating him? Mm-hmm. I've cooperated some really bad guys. I've cooperated murderers. I've done trials based on cooperators who were murderers. But boy, a serial child molester and child sex trafficker is a different story. And I'd have second and third and fourth thoughts about cooperating him if I was there.
Let me get a couple of calls in here. Oh, yes, Julie, please.
I just want to interject on that on an important point.
Yes.
The unit that is handling this case is the public corruption unit on this, which has really raised a lot of eyebrows on here. And what could be happening, and certainly I'm not on the inside, but knowing the case and how it worked out and the way that Epstein was pressuring these prosecutors. In fact, he hired one of them to work for him. And my understanding is that he dangled a lot of things before these prosecutors. So, and that combined with the fact that, you know, that other woman came out this morning on the Today Show, more victims are going to be coming forward. There's going to be an awful lot of pressure to figure out that whether any of these prosecutors had any kind of a quid pro quo involved in going along with this agreement. I'm not saying that there was, but there was a number of complaints filed against these prosecutors during the course of this case.
I want to get a listener in here, Noreen from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Noreen. If you could be brief, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. Hi. I just wanted to say that I see a parallel here between these child victims and Professor Blasey Ford and how her case was dismissed and how the senators did really not know the brain science and what happens when children are abused especially and why they don't report, because this is the kind of treatment they get. They're not really protected or can't be assured of protection in the criminal justice system.
Noreen, thank you very much. Julie Brenn, I know you have to leave us. There are a couple of last points I want to get to here. President Trump, responding to Alexander Acosta and the plea deal from 2008, I want to play what he said about all of this.
I feel very badly, actually, for Secretary Acosta, because I've known him as being somebody that works so hard and has done such a good job. I feel very badly about that whole situation. But we're going to be looking at that and looking at it very closely.
Julie Brenn, everything you know, should Acosta go?
Yeah, he should go. I mean, this is just a horrific, horrific injustice. And he was the person that really approved it happening. And I will also say part of the problem is he has not owned up to it. I think if he had owned up to it, even in his latest comments, he's saying, oh, new evidence. Well, what about the old evidence? I mean, he needed to own up to it and say, look, this was not, in hindsight, the best thing. And I'm going to cooperate, by the way, and have everybody, our whole team cooperate with them to finally bring him to justice. He's not doing that. He's still twisting things around to justify what he did. And I just think he has to go.
In our last 30 seconds, Julie Brown, part of the wording in the charges against Epstein talks about some sort of global solution here. Do I read that correctly to mean that there were not just victims in the U.S., that they were outside of the U.S. as well?
Yes, yes. There were, he had recruiters in other countries. When some of these women that he abused got to be 17, they were too old for him, but they were already tied to him and relying on him financially. So what he did was send them to various countries around the world and recruit underage girls to bring him under the guise that he was, they were going to promise them modeling careers and education opportunities.
Julie Brown, you've been covering this for a long time. Boy, you've just done exceptional work. What's the takeaway for you in this story?
Well, the takeaway is this was a very old story. It was a little bit hammered when it came out about whether, I got anything new. And my point in this is that some stories are never really finished, that you still have to keep pecking away at them to really find the truth.
You sure did. Julie Brown, Miami Herald investigative reporter behind the paper's groundbreaking series, Perversion of Justice. An honor to speak with you, and thank you, Julie.
Thank you.
Ali Honig, former federal prosecutor, Southern District of New York, as well as a CNN legal analyst. Ali, thank you for your perspective.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
After the break, listeners, we'll go inside Instagram's war on bullying. You can join that conversation. What's your experience with cyberbullying? I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. Well, teens love the gram, Instagram, that is. 72% of them use the platform, according to a recent Pew study. But in another recent survey, one in five people between the ages of 12 and 20 said they experienced bullying on the platform. Instagram is taking new steps to fight back against bullies. You can join the conversation. How has bullying on social media affected your family, your teenager? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. With me now from San Francisco is Katie Steinmetz, the San Francisco Bureau Chief for Time. You can link to her piece headlined Inside Instagram's War on Bullying. That's at our website, onpointradio.org. Katie, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
So what has prompted this war on bullying by Instagram?
Part of it is what you mentioned. Bullying is a problem everywhere, but the user base of Instagram skews young. Nearly 80% of teenagers, according to multiple estimates, are on Instagram, and between a fifth and nearly a half of them have experienced bullying. The executives say that they know this, that they have a responsibility because bullying disproportionately affects young people and their user base skews young to take the issue seriously. The broader context, of course, is that social networks are under pressure to prove that they can police their platforms and keep them safe for users as regulatory bodies look at stricter oversight and even the breakup of companies. And the new head, Adam Mosseri, is starting to define his own chapter for the company and says that the well-being of users is his top priority, that both there is a moral imperative to take bullying very seriously for the well-being of users and a financial one, that long-term it will be bad for the platform as a business if they don't get a handle on problems like that.
So that's interesting. This is a moment when social media platforms, of course, are being blamed for a lot of problems with our teenagers, and they're under pressure, as you say, from the government to demonstrate that they can police themselves. So what you're saying is maybe this is not so voluntary. Maybe they're being proactive here. Is that right?
I think in general, social networks are trying to take a more proactive versus defensive stance rather than waiting to see where the next fire is going to break out. They're trying to anticipate what is going to burst into flames. They've had so many problems they've dealt with, from trolling to hate speech to fake news to bullying, that rather than being hauled in front of Congress to account for how those problems came to be in the first place, they want to do a better job of getting out in front of them and saying, we're aware of this, we take responsibility for it, and we're doing something about it, and hopefully, you know, they want to say it's working.
So the forms that bullying have taken on Instagram have changed over time a little bit. Describe what bullying looks like today, how it's defined.
How it's defined is very tricky. I'll come back to that in just a second. A few examples first. There are a lot of what one might call old-fashioned forms of bullying on Instagram. The most common forms are things like mean comments, insults, and threats. But it comes in about every form that there is a feature on Instagram, photos and videos. Young people have videos and photos of themselves shared without their consent. There are so-called hate pages that are accounts that are expressly set up to mock or impersonate someone. People will take screenshots of one another's posts, they'll alter them and reshare them, or just make fun of them in group chats behind that person's back. Anonymous accounts are set up to spread rumors and gossip, including claims about sexual activity that can quickly spread around a teenager's entire school. People intentionally leave each other out by tagging several friends in a post and pointedly excluding someone. I mean, it takes an incredible variety of forms. Instagram is in the midst of extensive research to answer that first question of exactly what is bullying, in the hopes of doing better jobs of finding it on the platform.
Late last month, CBS This Morning host Gail King spoke to five teenagers who use Instagram every day. She asked how many had been cyberbullied, and they all raised their hands. Here's what two teenagers, Ashan and Jackson, had to say.
When I think of cyberbullying, I think of, like, pictures being posted, comments, like mean comments, threats being thrown around. It's just, like, uncalled for and just mean and heinous.
I try to ignore it, but the problem with cyberbullying is that you can't really escape it.
Yeah.
Because you can't escape your phone.
You can't escape it. You can't escape your phone. That's really at the heart of this, isn't it, Katie?
Absolutely. The home used to be a refuge for teenagers. You'd get bullied at school, and then home would be a safe place. But now the bullies can follow you wherever you are, and they can come at you all the time.
So what is Instagram exactly doing?
So Instagram is both launching new features to combat bullying and developing artificial intelligence that it hopes will do a good job of proactively rooting out bullying content in the future. So one new feature, for example, that they're rolling out now and hope to have live globally by the end of the year is called a comment warning. It uses artificial intelligence to scan comments as people are typing them out. And if it detects bullying content, even borderline content, before that comment goes live, it will give the user a warning that says, we believe this may contain offensive material. Are you sure you want to post it? And so they're hoping that with nudges like this, they can get people to rethink words, be kinder on the platform. In the meantime, a lot of effort is going into both that research to understand the forms bullying can take and what it looks like in order to build artificial intelligence that can proactively scan, you know, every post, every photo, every video, every comment, and hopefully get good enough to automatically detect bullying and delete it before people even have to report it to moderators.
A couple of questions that come up as you speak of this. I wonder about privacy issues attached to this, and has it been tested? I mean, have they looked at this? Has it worked?
Yeah, there are privacy issues. For example, a lot of bullying happens in direct messages, which are essentially private messages between two people. And Instagram does not proactively scan those. It's incumbent on users to report bullying if it happens in that space. And so Instagram says, you know, artificial intelligence really isn't going to help them there. They're trying to make reporting easier so that people can take care of that themselves. And they are in the midst of testing this. There are a lot of numbers Instagram won't share. With the comment warning, for example, they would tell me, yes, it does seem to be effective. After people have been given a warning, they do tend on average to rethink their words and post something that the classifier, the AI classifier, does not think is bullying. But they're not sharing numbers about exactly how much content the AI is flagging now, how many times it's flagging things that human moderators agree is bullying versus say that the classifier's made a mistake and
right.
they caught something
right.
that isn't. So it's hard to say exactly how good the technology is. It certainly is not as good as they want it to be and needs improving.
Listeners, we'd love to hear your stories, how bullying on social media has affected your family, your teenager. On that note, I'll bring another voice into the conversation. Sherry Bauman joins me from Tucson, Arizona. She's a professor of counseling at the University of Arizona, where she researches bullying, cyberbullying, and peer victimization. Also studies teacher responses to bullying. She's worked in public schools for 30 years, 18 of those as a school counselor. She's also a licensed psychologist. Sherry, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
So, what
do you
make?
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you for having. What do you make of these new features?
Well, I think it's commendable that Instagram is taking some responsibility to do something about the bullying that happens on their platform. On the other hand, I think, you know, the notion of rethink, which is flagging a message and asking, do you really want to send this, assumes that most of the unpleasant or mean comments are unintended. I think many of the people who post those kinds of comments would say, of course I want to post this. That's exactly what I want to say. So I question the fact that they're not working with researchers or sharing their internal researchers so we can evaluate the evidence. Is this type of approach worth the resources and time to develop it? And the other plan they're talking about is restricting followers to, because they know that young people are very reluctant to block or take obvious efforts to
against a bully.
Keep them right, because that often has unintended consequences, either in face-to-face interactions or the bully just choosing a different route. And my concern about that is that I don't know that if I were restricted, I wouldn't just open another account, because that's one of the affordances of Instagram that I think appeals to bullies. You can have multiple accounts, and there's no need for authentication. Nobody has to verify that you are, in fact, the person you say you are. So restrict me. Go ahead. Watch. I'm going to just make a new account and do the same thing. Mm. So I'm a little suspicious. Also, I know that artificial intelligence is an iterative process and takes a long time to get efficient. And the volume on these sites is just astronomical.
Right.
So that, I'm concerned that it's an ambitious but impossible task.
It's a big one, that's for sure. Ben is on the line from Des Moines, Iowa. I want to get him in here. Ben, how do you see this? Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I am just wondering why there can't be sort of a one strike and you're out. You know, if teens are so addicted to these platforms, if they bully, they are banned for life.
Ben, thank you. Katie Steinmetz, can Instagram do that? Would they?
Instagram will kick people off the platform. Again, that's something they're not going to share exactly of where is that threshold exactly, when do you get kicked off versus warned that a post contained bullying and you're not allowed to do that on the platform. And as Sherry points out, even when Instagram does take that step and kick someone off, it's very easy to get a new account and get back on the platform. So being proactive, you know, could help, but it's not going to fix the issue. And that also gets us into the thorny area of free speech. You know,
right.
when you're making these calls, it's really hard to say, you know, a lot of content will upset people that maybe should be protected as free expression. And the stricter you're being about the repercussions for that, kicking someone off versus giving them a warning, the more reason they have, you know, arguably to be upset if Instagram has made an overly harsh call that curbs free expression.
Ben, thanks for your call. Here's Amy in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Amy. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thank you. I'm not on Instagram, but my question is,
if you're being bullied, are you able to just block that person like you can on some other social media?
Katie?
Yes, you can block them. And what happens when you block them is two accounts essentially don't see each other anymore. They kind of disappear to one another on the platform. But what Instagram has found is that teenagers are really loath to do this for two reasons. One, it's really obvious when someone's been blocked. And so that betrays hurt feelings for a teen. The bully knows that they've gotten to them. And two, then they can no longer see what that bully is doing. Maybe the bully is still talking about them. Maybe they're still spreading rumors about them. They want to have that continued oversight. And this is where this new feature that Sherry mentioned, Restrict, comes in, where they're trying to ferret out a middle ground here where they can, where a user can kind of restrict the movements of a bully, can have more oversight without the bully being fully aware that anything has happened.
Rick in Elizabethtown, New York. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, my question is about whether defamation laws against libel and slander don't apply in some of these cases. If you were to make comments that affected somebody's reputation or made untrue comments about somebody in any other forum, you would be liable for the legal consequences of that. We're depending on Facebook and Instagram to put AI programs in place to keep these from happening. But when they do happen, can we not use defamation laws to get some sort of recourse?
Yeah, thank you, Rick. Good question. Katie, I'll turn that back to you.
Well, I'm not a First Amendment lawyer, so I can't tell you the exact details of how something like that would play out. I will tell you that there are different guidelines for how public figures and private individuals are treated when it comes to guidelines about bullying. We saw this in news this week, you know, sort of related to President Trump not being able to block people on Twitter, right? There are different rules for public figures versus private individuals when it comes to issues surrounding speech. While Instagram is certainly going to be aware of that when it comes to certain public figures, I don't think that when it comes to private individuals, that's a really practical, or quick means of enforcement when a teenager is sitting in a room, you know, deeply hurt that someone has claimed that they're, you know, promiscuous. You know, I don't think bringing in the courts and laws like that will bring quick enough resolution, even if it did apply to private individuals.
Sherry Bauman, you've been working with kids for decades.
100 years.
Yeah, right. Do you think these new changes on Instagram will actually make a difference? You're seeing these kids every day online, cyberbullying. Got about 30 seconds here.
I hope they will make a difference. I'm a little cautious and would like to see some of the numbers that they're gathering so we can make informed decisions and decide, is this the right approach? We also need to engage with young people. Would you use this feature? How would that affect your behavior? What do you need in the way of support if you are targeted? And I think we need to stop operating in silos, the academics and the media and the technology companies have a lot to share.
They do. And we'll have to pick this up later because it's an important conversation. We just got the tip of the iceberg here today. Sherry Bauman, Katie Steinmetz from Time Magazine, thank you so much for being with us. And listeners, thanks so much to you. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.